Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
¿Será que no quiere pensar en lo que pudiera pasar si la mayoría en la nación empieza a gritar revolución? Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente.
Hello, buenas tardes, Los Angeles. Good afternoon, LA. Welcome to this new and exciting episode of The Signal here on KPFK 90.7 FM. And you can always tune in on kpfk.org. Today we have a special episode. I'm going to start off by, you know, it's been a difficult week for all of us. It's been a difficult week for a variety of different reasons. You know, one of the benefits and challenges of having a one-hour public affairs talk radio show a week is that, you know, you have 5 days, 6, 7 days, essentially, to prepare. And one of the good things about that is that we oftentimes make time to make sure we try and put together a good broadcast for you all. And it gives us time to really look at what's happening on the week's news. Now, by that same issue, we find ourselves in a difficult position because sometimes we will coordinate a broadcast and then things happen, right? It goes without saying that this week, you know, in our immediate ecosystem of the Signal News Information and Analysis, we had two significant events that we want to bring to your attention. And for a variety of different reasons, you know, we have to shift our previous commitments. And I want to say thank you to our other guests whom we had to move around because we wanted to make space and time, particularly around this Charlie Kirk idea, or not idea, this tragedy. And I am going to say tragedy. We'll get into it shortly. But I do want to provide one additional update. Many of you may have seen on the news, you may have heard that earlier this week, and on Monday, in fact, the United States Supreme Court officially granted the federal government's request for a stay of the temporary restraining order that had been issued a short while back earlier this summer. Now, we at The Signal had been covering that issue, quite closely. We had had, on previous episodes, invited some of the lead counsel, some of the plaintiffs. So we've been keeping an eye on that case for very important reasons, one of which manifested this particular Monday. And that was that on Monday, the Supreme Court issued a ruling effectively suspending court protections that had shielded immigrant communities in Southern California from unlawful ICE raids. One thing is absolutely clear, folks, and let me say this very directly. The court's decision gives a green light to immigration agents to stop, detain, and arrest people based on how they look, what language they speak, or the kind of work that they do. This is unprecedented. For as long as most of us who are on this broadcast listening, and those of us here, even my board op, Wendell, who, you know, he's my boy, man, and I love him, and he's at least 175 years old, right, Wendell? And, you know, he can tell you that, you know, as long as we can all remember collectively, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution has always held firm. You cannot have your Fourth Amendment violations violated. Fourth Amendment rights, excuse me. And this Monday, the Supreme Court allowed ICE agents to, in fact, racially profile you. So, of course, the big question now is, does that mean that the Constitution does not apply to some of us in this country? Indeed, one of the big problems and one of the reasons this lawsuit was originally filed and why we started covering it here on The Signal was because you had folks, you know, people like me, slightly darker shade of brown, and others who were being summarily targeted, stopped, detained, questioned, and arrested. So this ruling for many of us, you know, we feared that this ruling was coming, given the composition of the Supreme Court. And while the community braced for its outcome, a deep fear now looms over the city, over the state, over the country, really. Because this isn't just a legal setback, ladies and gentlemen. At its core, it's a moral failure. It's a signal that legalized discrimination is alive and well, and it's emanating from the highest land, which is the Supreme Court. It was the Supreme Court who said, it's okay for ICE officers to stereotype you, to profile you, to stop you if they hear you speaking Spanish. So for us, it was important to cover this issue because it is transformative. It is transformative for our community. It is transformative for our audience. It is transformative for this city. It is transformative for this country. From what I've seen in the streets, even here in the studio and the conversations with advocates and other political champions, the message is clear. The community is not backing down. So as we prepare to go into this next phase of news, information, and analysis, we'll continue to bring this topic to you because we do believe firmly that it's these type of issues that we need to keep a close eye on. Many in our community strongly feel that this is the beginning of what is a systemic change being put forward by the current administration that we've seen in other areas. Rollbacks on protections for LGBTQ community. You know, rollbacks, other legal rollbacks that impact schooling, law enforcement, healthcare, Social Security. So we are without a doubt in a period in history in which our communities need to prepare for what is coming down the road. And that is a change that, quite frankly, many of us did not think. And let me close out this part of my opening commentary on this topic by sharing this. I had a reporter, actually, somebody in the industry asked me, hey, Dino, what do you think? Do you think this is worse than the time of the Gestapo, he said. And at first I thought, okay, well, you know, I see why many draw those parallels, sure. But my response to him was, well, actually, it's not like the time of the Gestapo. It is indeed very much worse, and I'm going to tell you why. Because the periods that saw the type of oppression, the type of exploitation and mass targeting and murder, subsequent murder, of individuals under the then Third Reich regime. Now, this is a period in history where you didn't have the type of advances there. You didn't have the type of growth and development of a society as we do today. And the fact that we have regressed back to that is, to me, one of the biggest concerns and why we keep covering this issue. Now, enough of the soapbox. You know, I do once in a while take moderator privilege, or I should say host privilege, and give myself the opportunity to talk about this. But to get that brief update back on this issue of the Supreme Court ruling, to give us a quick update on what's going on there, we're welcoming back Myra Joaquin, one of the lead counsels, senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California, and one of the lead counsels in the case of the Vasquez Perdomo versus Noem, who also helped secure the original temporary restraining order, helped defend this case at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and is now there on the forefront with her colleagues fighting this issue at the Supreme Court, which has approved the stay. Myra, welcome back to The Signal.
Thank you for having me, Dino.
Well, thank you. So, you know, I was kind of going off on my little soapbox there, expressing concern over some of these issues. And, you know, let's just do the basics, right? What exactly did the Supreme Court decide, and how did they justify it?
So on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court granted the government's request to stay the temporary restraining order that we had in place in the Central District. And it was a disturbing decision in the sense that there was no information about what led the majority to grant the stay request. There was no language supporting the stay request. All that we saw from the decision were a concurring opinion that was written by Justice Kavanaugh and no other justice. And separately, there was a dissent written by Justice Sotomayor that was joined by two other justices. But the decision to grant the stay request in itself did not provide us any information about the reasons that the court saw to grant the request.
So no real reason provided, which leaves all of us. I mean, I imagine you all in the legal team, those of us that are on the outside of that, in a very difficult environment. What does this mean for immigrant communities on the ground, especially those in Southern California?
At this time, it does mean that the temporary restraining order that was issued earlier this summer is currently on pause. There is no order that prevents the government from conducting stops that are based on the four factors that have been identified in the order, which are race, apparent occupation, location, or if someone speaks Spanish. This does not mean, however, that the government can continue to conduct lawless stops, which are any stop that is not based on reasonable suspicion. The law remains the same. The decision that we saw on Monday did not change the Fourth Amendment law that applies for how a federal agent can stop someone and arrest them or even ask them questions about their immigration status. That law has not changed. And so even though there's not an order in place that explicitly says you cannot use these four factors to stop someone, the government must still have reasonable suspicion before they stop anyone that person is in the U.S. in violation of immigration law, because if they do not have that information and if they are only stopping individuals at random, that can still be a basis to go back to the court and tell the court that they are continuing to conduct stops that are unlawful.
My guest is Myra Joaquin, senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California and lead counsel in the case of Vasquez Perdomo versus Noem. We're talking about this decision by the Supreme Court of the United States to grant the stay for the temporary restraining order or against the temporary restraining order issued earlier this summer that sought to mitigate the horrific roving patrols and roundups that were being executed by ICE and the Trump administration's draconian effort against migrants and other immigrants in this country. Myra, let's talk about the legal next steps. And is the case over? Or I know you mentioned that it doesn't change things, but you know, what's next in the coming weeks and months on this case?
Certainly, and the case is far from over. Generally, lawsuits, and so litigation does last many years. So we are still at the early stages of the case. There is a hearing that is set for September 24th, where there is a pending request for a preliminary injunction that could address other issues that are implicated in the case, including access to counsel. And there are other motions that are set to be heard by the court on that date. And so there's still a lot that will be done. And I think I can speak both for the legal team and for all our plaintiffs that everyone who's participating in this case is committed to continuing to protect the rights of all immigrants and communities within Southern California. And we will continue to explore every avenue that we have available to make sure that immigration agents are not conducting the kind of roving patrol stops that they were doing earlier this summer, that they're not violating people's rights when they stop someone, that they're not stopping people simply because of the color of their skin. And so there's a lot more to be done, and we will continue moving ahead. Well, Monday was a really disappointing decision. The team is preparing to move forward, and is doing so in the coming weeks.
And one more question before I let you go, Myra, and thank you for making the time. What can the community do? I know that there was a large effort, a strong effort, and wide call to have people document these experiences to ensure that we can have some sense of accountability when these actions are being executed against members of the community. What can people do moving forward as this is litigated in the courts?
First, it's really important that we continue to hear from the community whenever there is a stop by immigration agents in their homes or in their communities. We all need that information and to connect with people who may have been impacted by any stop by immigration agents so we can have a better understanding of what led the stop to occur, how the stop happened, information about what kinds of questions that person was asked, whether it was indeed a brief detentive stop in the way that Justice Kavanaugh seems to believe these are occurring, which we think is far from what's happening in reality. And so it is important for us to continue to connect with any individual who's being impacted by these stops so we can gather more information and so that we can go back to the court with current evidence as to what's happening on the ground and how immigration agents are conducting these stops.
Fantastic. And hopefully we can have you back in the coming weeks and months as this court case continues. Thank you very much, Myra.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for tuning in.
That was Myra Joaquin, one of the lead attorneys with the American Civil Liberties Union on the case of Perdomo versus Noem. She's a senior staff attorney at the ACLU talking about the Supreme Court decision to stay the temporary restraining order that is no longer in effect in Los Angeles. Stay with us. We'll be right back where we're going to touch on the strengthening of U.S.-Mexico relations through a special project, the Mexican-American Political Alliance. You'll hear more about it right away.
Su cerebro no está funcionando. ¿Será que no quiere pensar en lo que pudiera pasar si la mayoría en la nación empieza a gritar revolución? Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente. ¿Quiénes son tu gente?
Welcome back. The United States and Mexico are connected by geography, culture, and economy. Yet in today's political climate, we see growing isolationism. MAPA, the Mexican-American Policy Alliance, is pushing back on this. Next week in Mexico City, MAPA will host a summit, bringing together leaders from both sides of the border to strengthen collaboration and build solutions on a variety of issues. Immigration, health, energy, economic prosperity. And they're doing so in this environment and political culture we find ourselves in where isolationism seems to prevail on behalf of the federal administration we are all experiencing at this time. My next guest is Nora Preciado, who has long worked at the intersection of immigrant rights and binational collaborations and is the current co-executive director of MAPA. She helps lead policy dialogue and cross-border partnerships grounded in innovation and community power, and she is also an attorney by training. Nora, welcome to The Signal.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So let's get into this. How did this project first come to fruition? When did you guys develop this?
So the Mexican American Policy Alliance, or MAPA, as we lovingly call it, started as a project by Student Strategies because there was this really strong desire to strengthen the relationship between a region closely connected to Mexico, the Southwest, led by California. As Latino leaders, we saw this chance to work together on binational issues that affect people on both sides of the border. And we thought that in order to make that happen, MAPA needed to be created. It now includes 7 states in the U.S. that are part of this effort. But it really all began with open discussion among legislators and lawmakers, nonprofit leaders, and others from many different sectors who are committed to strengthening this collaboration, to developing policies to address binational issues, and to promoting cultural and human exchanges between Mexico and the U.S.
So, wow. So this started as a single initiative, if I understand correctly. You're saying there's now 7 states involved. That's significant. That's quite an accomplishment. Congratulations. As you navigate forward with this project, and this what is otherwise hostile, administration, growing isolationism, how has this project been received by these participants across these 7 states here on the U.S. side?
It's been really well received because, as you mentioned, right now we are seeing that federal politics are defined by fear, division, and, as you mentioned, isolationism. But the reality is that our communities can't afford to wait on Washington to get this right. That's why state and local leaders who see every day how closely we are tied to Mexico, whether it's by trade, jobs, education, culture, or all of our immigrant families and heritage, they saw the need to fill this void at the federal level. That's why MAPA is stepping in. We're creating a space for real collaboration that is rooted in trust and shared prosperity, especially in this time when we all know it's needed the most. We're not waiting on Washington. We're leading from our communities. The summit really is about replacing that hostility with partnership and that division with dignity.
So California and Mexico, California in particular, and as somebody who's navigated the public policy world for a while myself, you know, there's a long shared history of binational collaboration. What are some of the examples of the programs that you all are looking to lay groundwork in, right? As I mentioned in my intro, I know that in talking to you and leading up to this segment, we talked a little bit about health, economics, education, things of that nature. But give us an example on what a practical collaboration looks like.
Yeah, California and Mexico do have a rich history, as you mentioned, of this binational collaboration that has laid the groundwork for MAPA's vision. Some of the programs that highlight that collaboration include a doctor's program that places doctors in underserved communities across California. We've seen a number of cross-border student exchange programs that have created educational ties and have enriched the experiences of students both in Mexico and the U.S. We've also seen countless robust economic and trade partnerships in sectors like agriculture, energy, which is only going to increase, tourism, for example. Again, looking at this, driving the shared prosperity, we've seen public health and environmental collaborations along the border that address critical issues affecting both regions. And of course, we see often cultural initiatives that celebrate that interconnectedness in our heritage, strengthening that bond. MAPA is building on all of the successful programs by advocating for broader policy coordination, which is why we're so excited that there is now 7 states involved in this effort here in the U.S.
And we're pushing for a long-term vision that makes sure that the collaborative spirit that we are looking for continues to thrive and evolve, particularly to meet the needs of the moment, but also beyond.
Now, I'm excited about this because when I think of, you know, in the absence of real meaningful action on the part of the administration, the idea that some of you all are taking the this action, you know, into your own hands and saying we're going to do this. Whose state, federal elected officials are participating? When you say seven different states, who's coming together on both sides of the border?
So for the U.S., it's California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, Texas, Illinois, and Wisconsin, who will have legislative delegations representing at the summit next week. We also have leaders of the nonprofit, foundation sector, and leaders of industry from both sides. And from Mexico, we have federal officials in different secretarias in Mexico that are going to be helping push this work. We're trying to really, again, take the reins of this continued collaboration and not wait for Washington to lead, particularly because all the states are greatly positioned to do that.
And it sounds like these are also all states in which, back to one of our ongoing topics here at the Signal, politics, these are key, you know, battleground states, right? You said Illinois, Arizona. For the folks here, one of the things that I hear as somebody in the news world on particular topics, and I wonder if this will be one of them, I oftentimes hear things like, well, why should I care? I'm worried about X issue or Y issue and things that impact me here. And while that's always a valid concern relative, for those who are listening right now, why should they care that such a summit is happening in Mexico City?
Yeah, I think Los Angeles should really care because what happens between the U.S. and Mexico directly shapes life here, right? Our city is home to the largest Mexican diaspora outside of Mexico. So the ties that we're talking about aren't abstract. They're lived every single day by all Angelinos. When LA leaders are sitting down with Mexican leaders, we're talking about issues that impact people here at home, jobs, trade, immigrant integration, education, cultural exchanges. The MAPA Summit is about making sure that those connections are strengthened and protected. What happens in Mexico City matters here in LA because our economies, families, our future are truly inseparable. So I think that's why folks should care. And you talked about, you know, some issues that people are interested in. We're going to be focusing on many of them, right? And again, they have repercussions and impact on both sides of the border, whether it's trade, jobs, training, the economy, workforce development, the environment. All of these things are interconnected. And that's why I think all Angelinos should take note and care.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because one of our listeners and a local, in fact, a local elected official whose name I will not share, just texted me and said, you know, what the hell? How come I didn't hear about this? How do we get involved? So to share this text message, this angry text message I just got. So how will people get involved moving forward? Obviously, this is taking place this coming week. I went to my producer. I said, I think I should be there. And my producer, Nella, said, let me think about it. So we might be very well covering this in the coming weeks and months. But how can others get involved as this issue comes develops further?
Yeah, so I think our vision, if MAPA succeeds, is really, really very exciting. And I think there will be room and a role for everyone to play that's interested. We're hoping that in a year, we can see stronger partnerships between all the states that I mentioned and many more, particularly those that have strong Latino communities, and that federal officials and entities in Mexico and us can show some early successes in policy change. So whether folks are interested in moving policy forward or expanding networks of collaboration, there will be a place to do that. Our ambitious goal is that looking ahead 5 years, we aim to have a very solid binational framework in place that includes cross-border agreements, sustainable projects that benefit both countries. We want to continue to see long-term integration of cultural and policy initiatives. And really, our goal is to redefine U.S.-Mexico relations to be more collaborative, focus on people, being resilient, and creating this stronger bond between our nations. So I think that there will be a number of initiatives that will come out of the summit and are already underway, where folks with different interests on different strategies, on different issues, but that bring in that collaboration across borders, will find something of interest and something that will allow them to be involved in this effort.
Is there a website, Nora, that you would like to direct people to if they want to learn more about it, or if they want to sign up? Where can they go so that they can learn more and keep an eye on this issue as it develops?
Yes, the Mexican American Policy Alliance has a website. It is www.mexampolicy.org, and you will find information about our vision, who is involved in this effort, and past events. And we hope to create a page particularly on follow-up so that others can, after the summit, continue to work together. But there's also contact information there, so you can reach out to us if you're interested in engaging in the work that comes out of the summit.
Wonderful. My guest has been Nora Preciado, co-executive director of the Mexican American Policy Alliance. Nora, thank you for joining us and for giving us a look at the MAPA summit coming up next week and this important work building stronger ties across borders. This is The Signal on KPFK 90.7 FM. Stay with us. We'll be right back on Politics of Political Assassinations. My guest will be Dr. Claudia Sandoval, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Moreno Valley College. And we're going to take your calls, 818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735. It's going to be a difficult topic, but a much needed one. Stay with us.
Su cerebro no está funcionando. ¿Será que no quiere pensar en lo que pudiera pasar si la mayoría en la nación empieza a gritar revolución? Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que
as we delve back in, our next topic is something that's been at the forefront of just about every media source out there in a lot of our homes. Indeed, I came into the studio this afternoon, and you know, almost immediately my producer, Nell, and I touched on this topic. We actually restructured our program this week so that we can make space for you all to connect with us and have this conversation. And that's this issue of the Charlie Kirk assassination. What happened to Charlie Kirk is unsettling. Political violence doesn't heal. It doesn't repair. If anything, it adds trauma at every level imaginable. And yet, almost immediately after the news broke, reactions split. Some celebrated his death. Others demanded dignity. Still others said, hey, the chickens came home to roost. There were even people dancing on video, online, in one of the many interwebinet social media platforms that are out there. So what does that say about us as a society? That's the one thing that I immediately defaulted to. At the same time, we saw the opportunists of the world, politicians spinning narratives and, you know, media assigning blame with absolutely no evidence. And indeed, those chickens did, in fact, come home to roost. That, too, is a reflection of who we've become. The truth is, folks, that this is an emotional issue for a variety of different reasons, not just the politics of the times we live in, but it's an emotional issue. You know, I want to add something to this, and I mentioned this to my producer that I was going to add a little additional personal note. On the way in this afternoon, as I was driving in here to the studios, I got a message, an emergency message, that my local school had just gone into lockdown. As a parent, as a father, as a concerned member of the community, as a citizen of this country, as a resident, you know, every emotion crossed my mind, especially because my student, one of my kids is a student worker who's there on a Saturday afternoon. And I had to pull over for a second and think, what do I do? Of course, your first instinct as a parent is, let me turn around and go see what's happening. There's little to no information. The alerts start coming in. School lockdown. And the case of where I live in a small southeast city, I got it from both the city, the police officers or the police, local police agency, and of course the school itself. And immediately, you know, the calls start ringing out, trying to connect with your child. And there's this moment of desperation and you can't help but to feel an absolute sense of horror, this uncertainty. But at the same time, at least in my case, try and be measured in what I did next. I kid you not, a part of me said, I can turn this car around and drive back 45 minutes, if not longer, and little to nothing can I do. I certainly can't go in there and bust open a can of whoop-ass on whomever is the one that's causing this trouble. No, it doesn't work that way. Well, as I was deciding that, you know, I did get a message from my kid, and thank God nobody in the school was in harm's way, and things kind of started rolling out. But since I last connected, it's been 45 an hour, and they've still been in lockdown, and we now know that there was an incident outside that resulted from a car chase. And, you know, it got me thinking, right, as I was then driving in the final 20 minutes and I was connecting with my producer and we're thinking like, oh my God, we need to change this whole format. I have so much more to say. It's just one of those very complicated emotional topics. Charlie Kirk represents both a reflection of American society's deep roots in bigotry and racism and a singular figure who actively shaped and spread those ideas. He is not simply a product of his environment, or was a product of his environment, but he was also an architect of his own destructive influence. In the end, his downfall was not imposed from the outside, but indeed nurtured by his own hands, the inevitable consequence of a career built on amplifying prejudice. Put simply, Kirk became a victim of his own success, one could argue. But if we stop here, we miss the larger point. His rise and fall should not be read as an individual story, but as a mirror held up to our politics and culture. The danger is that leaders, rather than recognizing the damage done, will seek to profit from his legacy, adding fuel to the fire that consumed him, the very fire that consumed him. My guest on this topic is Dr. Claudia Sandoval, Assistant Professor of Political Science from Moreno Valley College. She is an analyst, a political commentator, and I invited her to come share with us. She has a background. In her area of expertise, she explores issues of power, justice, and civic responsibility. She helps students and communities make sense of democracy and its failures in real time. So as we prepare to go into this topic, and again, I do want to hear from you all, 818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735. Hit the option one so that you can get directed to the studio. And please be thoughtful of your comments. Remember that these are emotional issues. And while we are interested in hearing your intelligent reflections on this topic, we don't want to hear drama or any kind of outburst. Please, you will get cut off. You are not going to be given a moment to profile yourself. So, Professor, going back to you, the reaction to Kirk's death turned quickly from shock to celebration. What does that say about the health of our political culture?
Armando, first of all, thank you so much for this invitation. I'm very happy to speak with you and your audience. I think that, you know, what this tells us about the health of our political culture is that we're a little sick right now, right? I think that it's really unfortunate that we're experiencing this moment where empathy seems to be the topic on both sides of the political aisle for some reason. And, you know, I think that it's a little hard for me because I don't know that I saw celebration as much as I saw a reflection of this is what happens when you speak these types of horrors into existence, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Charlie Kirk said empathy was not good for our democracy, right? He made a point to say when there were school shootings, don't let the emotions get the best of you, right? Let's not let the emotions keep us from our path of allowing people to have guns, right?
Yeah.
And then he said, you know, a death is a sacrifice that we all have to accept. And so I think that what we're seeing when people say they're celebrating is not so much celebration, again, it's that he said these things when other people were hurting. And now you're asking everybody who has felt that pain over and over and over again, whether it's because we're mothers, we have heard of school lockdowns, you know, in our close proximity, or we know somebody who has lost somebody in a tragic mass shooting, that now you're asking us to value one life more than all the other lives that we've mourned, right? And it's not about not valuing his life, but rather reflecting on his own words to say this is what he wanted from a society, right?
Right.
And, you know, people can make mental gymnastics to make them mean something else than what, you know, he said. But I think a lot of people are using this moment to say he would have wanted us to not celebrate, you know, to not empathize with his family. Because he didn't want us to empathize with all of the families in Uvalde. He didn't want us to empathize with all the people from the Pulse nightclub.
Dr. Sandoval.
And so what do you do?
So what do you do? Okay, so I'm glad you say that. You know, the day that this happened later that evening when I got a chance to talk to my kids, right? One is an adult on his own. The other one's wrapping up her high school career. And I asked them. I asked them both, "What do you guys make of this?" And one of the responses I got was, "You know, this is the type of person that you either really loved or you really hated. But at the end of the day, you taught us." One of my kids said, "You know, killing is bad under any and all circumstances." While the other one said, "Well, around here, everybody just kind of called him the D-bag," you know, and as we start to tackle this, right? I mean, I saw it as a lesson, as a teachable moment. Well, let's talk about what does it mean to have this kind of this kind of a gruesome death played out live, or you know. On social media, which essentially it was. You know, some say everyone deserves a level of respect. And you touched on something very important, because this is an individual who built a career on the opposite of empathy. And again, as I pointed out in my opening, one could argue that the chicken came home to roost to him, right? So as we talk about this idea of compassion, you know, where is the line between empathy and accountability in the political environment we're living in today?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've been seeing some posts online where I think we're confusing a couple of things, right?
Okay.
And people are saying he didn't deserve to die. I mean, no one technically deserves to die, but we are all going to die, right? But he didn't deserve to die like this, and I agree. And I think most people agree that nobody deserves to die in such a gruesome and horrible and even public manner, right? But at the same time, we live in a moment in time where I open my social media posts, and just a few days ago, I saw a video of a child who was crying and screaming and walking aimlessly around his decapitated mother and blown up father. That kid also doesn't deserve to experience that, right? And I think here it's that people assume that we're saying he deserved it. No, most people have said nobody deserves it. And why haven't we done anything to stop anybody from experiencing this type of trauma? And unfortunately, you draw the line down to leadership and people of power, and he was one of the reasons why we can't stop from experiencing this type of horrible, horrible visual realities, right? He did not deserve it.
Right. So, okay. So I'm glad you're making that distinction, right? Because, I think as a general ground rule, right? Nobody wants to sit there short of you being somebody who's completely off the, in any and all ideological, emotional, social, and otherwise human spectrum to say this person needs to die for any random reason, or particularly I oppose or I'm against that particular topic, would be just horrific. Right. That said, you know, and you already touched on some of these issues. This is a person who, you know, openly said, hey, it's okay if some people die.
Right.
I mean, to me, right. I found that wild. I got to make a confession. You know, I knew very little. I knew this guy existed. I'd not paid attention. It's not something on my, on my issue areas that I cover. And since this assassination, I've been inundated with videos and messages. And as I shared with others that we were going to be, or others called me and said, are you going to cover this issue on your show? Yes. And since then, I've come to the conclusion that I probably found every single video clip of this guy and the crap he espoused repulsive and absolutely bigoted, if not open out racism. But again, I still wouldn't say he deserved to die. You know, Jim from Glendale sent us a message and says, ask Dr. Sandoval what she thinks is most broken in our society and how do we heal from it?
Yeah.
Sandoval? Tell us which one is most broken.
I honestly think the thing that is most broken in our society is our ability to think critically. And I think that that's something that is quickly becoming the thing we're losing the most, right? We are asked to believe in this and not believe in that and believe in this and not believe in that without any real substantive conversation of why or why not. And we're doing so as we're also, you know, asking our federal government to eliminate certain types of education that an administration doesn't agree with. And we're also asked to cancel culture because we should all have liberty to say whatever we want, except for not those things.
Right.
And so we're losing critical thinking, and that is what is making us act as a society in a way that isn't allowed to think.
Mm. Dr. Sandoval, I know that we're keeping you a little longer than we originally agreed. Can we take a call from Orange County?
Yes, absolutely.
Jelani from Orange County, what say you on this topic?
What's happening? First of all, peace. I love the radio station. I'm a big fan. I'm a big hip hop head. And I remember back in the day when Tupac Shakur was assassinated. A lot of people from the left and the right were saying, "Oh well, you look at his musical content, you look at what he was saying, and it's inevitable that he's going to be unalive by his words that he put into the ether and what he chose to put out there. Some of that, I'm definitely a believer in, I don't like karma energy, because that's what it is, you know, it's energy. So the energy you put out is the energy you put in. So, like I said, it was people from the left, right, basically it was more of a Caucasian field assignment to say that he died because of XYZ. And so as far as, you know, trying to mourn for this man, they try to, you know, just do the opposite. So anyway, it's contrast and hypocritical contrast where you see this dude basically, you know, putting what he put out in the ether. And like the lady in front of me said, it's not that people aren't, quote-unquote, mourning, but it's just the fact that people aren't making blasphemy of the death at the same time. Like, a death is a death. Anybody that dies, it's unfortunate, it's sad. Now, a lot of times when people die, it's their last bit of, okay, what did I do here on this planet? To where this man, obviously, in the midst of him talking, the words he was saying was, in fact, spilling a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff that come back and just bites in the backside. And I believe that's what happened. And it's not that people are happy about it. It's just, you look at the overall hypocrisy of everything going on. It's, if we do it, if Hunky Dory, if they do it, oh, look.
Right, right. And now, of course, we now know that, you know, that's...
Right.
We now know that, you know, this individual is indeed a conservative. This individual comes from a family of gun owners and others who have been staunch supporters of the Trump administration. And even just before we went to air, there is some additional allegations that I won't go into because we've not been able to verify ourselves. But, you know, Dr. Sandoval, he brings up, Jelani brings up an interesting point. I remember this period when the murder of Tupac Shakur happened, and there was this fervor out there about this individual who, through his artistic medium, decided to paraphrase some of the comments back in those days, you know, describe and tell the story of a subculture that is very much prominent in our society. So my question to you is this particular period we're living in a reflection of what maybe, am I overstepping when I say that the collapse of political morality is upon us, or has that already happened?
I think that there's a little bit of the political morality has declined, absolutely. I mean, I think it's also defined by how we define that type of violence. You know, people are calling it political violence. We think of some political violence as necessary, and some, like what happened this week, unnecessary and gruesome, right? But we spoke about this a couple days ago. What about what's happening in our Black and Latino communities, where, you know, families are stressed, they're anxious, they are depressed? Is that not a type of political violence too?
Absolutely.
And we, you know, people seem to think that that's okay. And so I think it is a reflection of, you know, some type of decline in our social morality when we say, you know, it's okay that these people are suffering because they deserve it, but other people don't deserve it.
That's right. That's right. We have time for one more call. Enrique from Newport Beach. Enrique, what's your take on all of this? Enrique, you there?
Enrique, I really think you was calling me. I can barely hear you. The only comment I have is that it came to me the fact that they killed Malcolm X before, and it was somebody that was advocating for the situation of the black people. And all of a sudden, there came an Anglican or the little radical, both were radicals, and in the black and the white side of the people. It's like they assassinated the Martin Luther King. No, excuse me, the Malcolm X,
right,
of the white people.
Yeah,
it makes sense to me because it was the same thing.
Okay.
And
thank you, Enrique.
Enrique
from Newport.
You're welcome.
Enrique from Newport Beach is drawing a parallel that, quite frankly, I've not heard it. You know, are there parallels here between a staunch advocate for his community and people, as was Malcolm X, and then this guy, which, you know, again, I've not heard this framing yet. But Dr. Sandoval, as we begin to wrap this up, let's go to you for one final message in this on this topic. And so what's your message to our community today as we look at how there's a rush to politicize this tragedy? What role do everyday people play in how we engage or disengage on issues of apathy and this climate of ours? What's your final message to our listeners as we continue to navigate the next coming weeks, which will likely be difficult?
Yeah, I think my message would be that I think we have to take a stand on all types of violence, and no matter who it impacts, right? We can't be selective that they deserve it, they don't deserve it. I think we need to put a stop to that type of language, and we need to tell our leadership to stop that type of language. We now have a Department of War. We now have a president who does AI images on social media that says that he's, you know, he wakes up every morning happy to see people suffer. I think we have to, as people who give our government power, they don't have power over us. We give them power to tell them that it's done. We want peace for everybody, right? And that includes people that we disagree with, but we want to be able to do that without fear of repercussions, without fear of having our families separated, without fear of having our community members criminalized. And it really does take a society that realizes that the power is with them to speak up and to speak up for others.
For others.
It's okay to speak up for others.
And that's a great note to end on. My guest has been Professor Dr. Claudia Sandoval, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Moreno Valley College, who joined us to discuss the Charlie Kirk assassination, this unsettling period that we're all going through. I want to thank Dr. Sandoval and all of my guests, Myra Joaquin and Nora Preciado, for this. And I leave you with this note, folks, as we prepare to close out. You know, the task before us is different. We need to learn to heal and build something better. That means resisting the temptation to meet hate with hate and insist that instead we center dignity, truth, and justice, even if we see our leaders around us unwilling to do that. Communities must find a way to confront the ideas that Kirk stood for, without reproducing the cruelty that he helped normalize. Healing requires investment. Healing requires building civic spaces that foster dialogue, protection, and for the most harmed, a way to get out of that trauma. With that, I want to thank my producer, board operator, producer Nella, board operator, and leave you with the next show, the car show, coming up next. Remember, you can check out this program and all others at kpfk.org. We'll see you next week. Stay safe out there. Take care.
Señor presidente, lo que traes en la...
DJ Namde from Radio Aphrodisia. Join us every Saturday as we nice up your weekend. It's all about music from Africa and the African world. Radio Aphrodisia, 4 to 6 p.m. It's Champeta Criolla from the coast of Caribbean, Soca Calypso, Juju Music, Musica Afro-Cubana, Cha-Cha-Cha, Afrobeat High Life. It's all in the mix. Radio Aphrodisia.